Mackenzie.
Lamar R. I keep having to match your syllables here. You change.
I appreciate it, honestly. I want to try out some weird ones in the next month or so and see what you're willing to throw back
at me. It's hard. With Lamar, it's hard. I'm just saying. I'm working here.
Anyway. Yeah, we got different number of syllables makes it difficult. So I know we're on kind of a short runway here today, but we want to get right into The Mummy because I think we both enjoy this one. Dumb as it may be at times, it is a fun fucking movie. So real quick warm up here. Do you have a favorite movie monster when you think about like mummies, werewolves, zombies, any of those? Do you have a favorite?
Like a specific character of a monster or just any, like a genre of monster?
Yeah, genre. Let's go genre.
My genre of monster, like I'm definitely a vampire girl. Like I grew up in the in the vampire era. Yeah. Yeah. I think I was a devotee.
You gotta be careful saying that though. Cause right vampire there? Era means very different things to, you know, 20-year-olds now who are Twilight fans.
Okay. But this is Anne Rice, the OG, the gem, the queen right there on my shelf. As I was pointing out, I was a big Anne Rice fan. So, well, she also did a lot of witch stuff, but I was,
Interview with a Vampire?
Yeah. The whole series of all the vampires. Okay. So like she did the Vampire Chronicles is her thing. And it starts with actually the Vampire Lestat, not Interview with the Vampire. And then they do the Mayfair Witches. She also did, which they made a TV show of that recently. So that's why I say that.
There were multiple interviews with vampires?
It's funny you say that. In the book, no. But in the TV series, yes, there are multiple interviews with the vampire.
The vampire monologues, if you will.
If you will. Yeah. You know, who doesn't want to listen to an old vampire tell their life stories? I feel like, again, sign me the fuck up. I want to know what all the shit you've been through.
Yeah, I'm imagining a bunch of very emotional vampires on stage, like doing
slam
poetry. That's
literally who Lestat is. Yeah. He's a very emotional man. Like, yeah. Anyways. And Louis as well. Oh, Louis, such a whiner. But moving on, what's your genre?
I mean, you know me. I'm probably a zombie guy at the end of the day. I feel like I've watched so many good, bad, mediocre zombie films over my lifetime. And I know that we had a surplus a decade ago of just way too much getting made when you had Walking Dead on TV and you had a million movies being put out. But I'm still a sucker for a zombie film. And I know 28 years later is coming out next year, and that's technically not zombies, but it's close.
What would you say is a good zombie movie? Like, for example, I didn't see a lot of them because I'm not a zombie person, but did you like World War Z? For example.
I didn't enjoy World War Z because it was I liked the book that it's based on, but I didn't love the visual effects in World War Z. I feel like when you digitize zombies, it's a lot less. I like the zombie genre because of the possibilities of the makeup effects and the practical stuff that people like Greg Nicotero and Tom Savini throw into the mix. So any of the George Romero ones, the first three are pretty damn good.
I just don't like that zombies break a lot of rules. You know what I mean? Like, one second, they're like mindless zombies who can't do anything. And the next second, like in World War Z, they're climbing fucking walls that are, it's unrealistic.
It's
also read that book and I was like, I didn't even love the book that much.
It's a wide ranging genre. I mean, much like vampires, like sometimes vampires have reflections. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes vampires sparkle and date.
I mean,
Kristen
in
Stewart.
The same movie, that's what I mean. It's like when in the same content, they break the rules in their own content. Like, this was my complaint about Dawn of the Dead. It's like they're mindless. They can't do anything. And then all of a sudden they're beating everybody's ass. I'm like, I can't follow that.
Okay. But, well, this gives us a reason to go back and watch Dawn of the Dead again. Cause you brought it up this episode.
Never again.
Then I will keep an eye out and see what inconsistencies you're talking about.
But. Okay. Welcome back to We Drink and We Watch Things. I'm Mackenzie.
I'm Lamar.
And we are kicking off Fan Jam this week with one we're both actually excited to talk about, which is fun. I don't think we're going to be able to say the same for all of Fan Jam, but this one's going to be fun. The Mummy, 1999.
Yeah, I was very glad to see this win the poll. Not that I didn't want to. I had just rewatched Everything Everywhere All at Once like a few months ago. And I was like, I really like that movie, but I don't know that I want to watch that again so quickly. And Arrival I liked, but that one's...
I loved Arrival.
That feels like it's there's like going to be a lot of research on linguistics to really cover that
movie. It's a very
movie.
Intellectual sci-fi film. And I mean that in the best way. I think it's so good. But yeah, this was a tough category. Like, I literally got messages from people who were like, what the fuck?
This why is are rude. They pitted against what? Each other?
This is like, this is impossible. And I go, yeah, why do you think we're outsourcing the gig? Like, I don't right. want to pick. So, you know, anyways, and these are, just to be clear, as we kick off this month, these are cumulative requests from you guys, like from emails, from DMs, from months and months of this. So we kind of focused in on some like for like genre-ish and yeah. tried to create some categories out of a very wide range of requests. But yeah, excited that this one got picked to kick us off. We have a fun cocktail to go with it as well. What is this one today?
Yeah, so this is kind of, as always, at Craft World, who came up with this concoction. It's delicious. This is kind of a spin on a Gold Rush, which makes sense given, you know, the plot of this film. But mm-hmm. it's 2 ounces of whiskey, 0.75 ounces of lemon, 0.75 ounces of honey syrup, which you can make yourself. It's just water and honey. Just heat it up and there you go. But what I like about it is Skylar also had us throw in about 0.5 ounce or less of mezcal to give it some smokiness. And then we tried our best to do a floater of creme de cassis,
so hard.
Which is yeah. like a blackberry liqueur. And both of them sank directly to the bottom.
I did Aperol, I will say. So we okay. had our choice of floater, and you did creme de cassis, yeah, whatever, it's always, and I did Aperol.
I'm going to be drinking all of that at the very end of this glass. But I will say this drink is delicious, and we're calling this one The Wrong Side of the River, just like Brendan Fraser.
Great Brendan Fraser impression.
Thank
I love
you.
It.
Thank you.
We had a slew of name choices yeah. this week, and I actually heard some others as I was watching it that I was like going to suggest maybe, but this was just the most fun. We love this line delivery, and we thought with the floater we were going to make it look right, and yeah, our execution is off. So, but whatever, it tastes good. So, cheers.
Cheers.
All right. Well, we're going to, like we said, we want to get right into this one. We have a lot to say. It was just kind of a good time to watch. So we're going to kick some basics off. The Mummy, 1999, as we clarified. There is an OG in 1932, if you didn't know.
Great year, 1999. They wrote a song about it.
They did. It was a good year. You know, let's just all go back to 1999. Anyway, I digress. 7.1 out of 10 on IMDb. Mixed critics and audience feedback from Rotten Tomatoes, 62% for critics, which, like, I don't know, checks out, and 75% for audiences, which was actually lower than I expected, especially given the box office on this one.
This feels like one of those had to be there. I think you had to be in a certain age group when this
to
came
really
out.
Really enjoy this.
Yeah, I feel like if you were over 30 or maybe 40 or under a certain, or you're just seeing it in the last 10 years, you're probably not going to appreciate it. It feels like you had to have really been there seeing this in 99 at the right age to love this as much as you and I do.
Who has like a I don't know, what is the current generation? God, I'm showing my age so bad. Gen Z, what's younger than that? We need somebody with
Zennials.
A kid or a friend, Zennial, whatever, to watch this and report back.
They're going to hate the visual effects calling it out right now. A lot of them have not aged well. So I think a kid
it's
watching
so
this
funny.
Now would be like, what the fuck?
It's so funny you say that because I was kind of going to give it credit. Like, I think it does. It ages
50,
pretty
50,
well.
50,
but
50.
Brand new. Yeah. If you've never seen it. Yeah. Like, I think you can give credit to it if you saw it then. You're like, oh, this was pretty cool back then. But anyway. Okay. We'll get into it. So the director here, Steven Summers, he's done some real gems. Sure. G.I. Joe, Rise of the Cobra, Van Helsing, which I think I've mentioned on the pod before of like, if you haven't seen it, I think this is one of those that's like maybe so bad it's good.
Huge
I haven't
Jack
watched
man.
It.
Yeah.
Yeah. I haven't watched it in a long time, so maybe not. But I remember watching it and like, I literally bought that movie. It was also in this era of my life where I bought every movie that I watched, but I had it for years before I finally sold it to Half Price or something. But anyways, it's an interesting time. He's done all the Mummies, of course. He also did the live action Jungle Book that was done in 94, which I think was universally panned.
I don't even know that existed.
Yeah, like I don't think it was well received. He's kind of a mixed bag. So
wait, was that the one with Bill Murray?
I never saw it, but I think so.
Because there's been another live or CGI Jungle Book, right? Since then?
Yes, there's been a later one. I don't remember which one is which.
I didn't see either. I know Bill Murray's in one, so.
I'm a purist. Like, the animated one is the one. Like,
which, if you want to hear us talk about Jungle Book more, go listen to last week's episode all about Eve, because there's a little crossover there.
We did have some Jungle Book mention, exactly. Yeah. So anyways, he's a good time.
I noticed about him, I promise to not interrupt as much today, but like, I looked at his film history.
I don't believe you.
You called it out. He's got a lot of garbage on his plate. And from what I can tell, this is just a guess based on solely his IMDb history. he made bank off this film because it did so well and it outperformed. But I think he took all that money and then just started producing, directing, and writing all his own shit. Because if you look at a lot of the Mummy sequels, you look at that G.I. Joe movie, you look at, he did something in 2013, Odd Thomas. He made a bunch of garbage. Like, he produced his own stuff. And none of it is great. He didn't even get invited back for the G.I. Joe sequel, which most people will say was better than the first. Not by much, but it was better. And I think his last movie that he directed was in 2013. The last one he produced was 2018. So I think he really made bank off the Mummy and made a lot of bad decisions after that.
Yeah, you know, maybe he's doing fine, though.
I mean, I hope he's happy. I'm not trying to critique the guy, but just professionally, maybe don't produce all your own films. Maybe get other people to invest and say, this is a good idea. I would like to put some money in that, please.
Yeah, not all the best decisions, we will say. He did also write the screenplay for this, which he did pretty well. I will say, this is a long and winding road, folks. If you didn't know, this was in development for well over 20 years with, I think, literally a half dozen to almost 8 to 10 people touching the screenplay or the story at various points. So there's a ton of folks who are uncredited in this respect. He did write the final version, but it was from, I mean, the brainchild of, again, almost a dozen people. Lloyd Fonville is credited. Kevin Jarre is credited for the story here, but he wrote the screenplay itself. But the original screenplay that this is based off of ends up being closest to the source material. So that's John L. Balderston. He is not credited because there was so much that was reworked on it. But really, this thing came full circle. It was supposed to be a like sexy mystic story. One was supposed to be in modern times. One was supposed to be like in a museum. Another one was going to be that this was a Terminator-esque character. There were so many iterations of this story before it got to what it is.
You called that out. I don't think you can tell that this went through so many. It does feel like a tightly, for a 2-hour film, I feel like they script it really well of like, if you guys listen to our Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom episode, I said that I really like 50% of that movie and the other 50% kind of feels fillery and like we're kind of plotting to get to the interesting parts. And this also does benefit personally for me from having so many horror movie elements in it, in addition to being action packed. But this feels like they took that formula for Temple of Doom and perfected it of just, we're just going to have these sequences, but we're going to break it up with likable characters. So to your point, I think the script, even though so many hands were on it, it feels cohesive and it does feel like it flows really well and it doesn't stretch out too much over the course of a 2-hour film.
Well, I should say also, like, some of those various iterations in prior forms were abandoned.
Oh, they just got scrapped. Okay.
Right. They just got scrapped. It went through a lot of different versions before Universal finalized that they wanted it to be this version. Like, it was going to be, to your point, a very low budget horror film at the start. It was going to have a $10 million budget and it was going to be a really simple, straightforward story. And that was actually in the Romero days when he was touching it as well and attached to direct. And so he slowly abandoned the project. So a bunch of people abandoned this and came up with different versions of it. Some people did want it to be horror. Some people did want it to be like sexy romance, you know, otherworldly. But the iteration that it came into was largely Kevin Jarre's brainchild, right? And so that's why he is credited. And actually, it's funny you call it Indiana Jones because that was one of the inspirations, is they've wanted it to be an Indiana Jones type of hero who's being like a little bit thwarted by the villain here and there. And it shows.
There might be a little copyright infringement going on here.
There's definitely like some Indiana Jones-esque behavior, but I feel like he still feels like a unique character. So it doesn't feel like a copy paste to me at all.
He's more playful. Brendan Fraser's character, or O'Connell, more like less of a badass. Like, he's heroic, but he doesn't feel invincible.
Right. He feels human. He feels like a badass and he could, you know, fuck you up, but he's not invincible. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, getting into the cast and crew here a little bit more. So
can
Brendan
I pause
Fraser,
you? I want to play a game, not like Jigsaw style, but I feel like we could do something really fun here because everyone talks about how this is just 90% of the world's bisexual population stemmed from this movie in 1999. Don't quote a source on that.
I was going to say, is that a stat that we can reference?
Definitely
like,
not. Definitely
what is
not.
The
point
material?
Being that everyone in this is so fucking attractive. So I was thinking you and I could do like a snake draft. You pick somebody, I pick, like, let's go through the cast, but let's see who ends up with the more attractive list. How do you feel about that?
Okay, we can totally do that. You're gonna, I'm never good at this game. Like, I don't ever remember the rules. So you're gonna have to guide me through this. But yes, we can do this.
So, well, do you want first pick or do you want the second and third pick?
I want first pick.
Okay, so you will pick who you think is the most attractive member of the cast. You can go through their sort of movie history. Then I will take two and three, and then we'll go until we get through the top eight, and we'll just compare lists. It'll be fun.
Okay, so Oded Fehr, who plays Ardeth Bay,
good choice,
is the most beautiful man, which I was going to talk about when we got there. Like, he is, chef's kiss. Like, one, his narration, his voice, beautiful, gorgeous. Talk to me all night, sir. Also, just look at him. He is gorgeous AF. And if you look at pictures of him now, he has salt and peppered so well. He's a beautiful
man.
Like
a fine wine.
He's a beautiful, beautiful man. Yeah.
Yeah. Ballsy move for a first choice, but I give you credit for taking him up top. He was in, what, Deuce Bigelow?
Deuce Bigelow, Mummy. He does all the mummies, and then Deuce Bigelow, and then Resident Evil. He's
also a couple of the Resident Evil films. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he kind of, I mean, I don't want to say he peaked at this point, but to your point, he still looks damn good.
He does still look damn good. I wish that people would cast him more so I could keep looking at him.
All right, well, you're going to have to do most of her movie history, but with the second overall choice, I'm going to take Evelyn. I'm going to take Rachel Weisz. So I obviously remember her gorgeous. From like, yeah, I remember her from just this, but also The Lobster. She's really good in that, and that came out, like 10 years ago.
Oh my God, that movie is so,
it's weird.
We can talk about that
it's
forever.
It's very strange. Anyway. But yeah, I'm going to take Evelyn. What else you got for her?
She did Disobedience, which is actually her taking a turn as a queer character as well. And she does a beautiful job in that. She's also probably most well known for The Constant Gardener. That's when she is, gosh, I always mix these people up and it pisses me and everyone else off. I think that's a Ray Fiend moment. Yeah, I think it is a Ray Fiend moment. Anyway, they were in that together. Ray Fiend. Yeah, I think that they did that together. And it's a romance, but it's like a epic romance. Anyway, very well done. She's beautiful in that.
Oh, she was in What's The Fountain fun. Too.
Forgot She's in The Fountain. Fountain. She also, I wanted to call out a couple of her like not as well-known ones, but that I personally love and highly recommend, which is About a Boy. She does a really good turn in that if you've never seen that.
I have that book. I would want to wait to see the movie though. That's Hugh Grant, right?
Yeah, it's Hugh Grant. Mm-hmm. The movie's really good. I own it if you want it. It's very good. It's very funny. And then Runaway Bride, which is just like a fun thriller with her and John Cusack, but it's like, and Gene Hackman and Dustin Hoffman, actually, as I say this out loud. It's such a good cast. It's so
Isn't
fun.
Isn't Runaway anyway. Bride Julia Roberts?
Not Runaway Bride. I'm sorry. Runaway Jury. Did I say okay, bride? I said bride.
I was like, you mentioned all these cast members, but not Julia Roberts. I was like, I don't know that that's right.
Also, Runaway Bride is a fun time, but it is not a thriller by any means. Sorry, my bad. Runaway Jury, which is a fun one. Yeah.
I also want to apologize, listeners. We're recording this the same day as our Christmas episode, so I'm going to still be jingling. So if you hated last week, you're not. I have my little jingly sweater here.
And I'm going to be sneaky, which this, again, like, this is Works appropriate for the mummy. Yeah, yeah. We're on theme, but in very different ways today.
We're doing our best. Happy New Year, everybody. This will be a New Year's episode. Forgot about that. But
indeed,
I'm going to go with the third overall pick. I'm going to take our other main cast member. He's not, I feel like the one thing missing from Brendan Fraser in this is I kind of wish he had a beard because Brendan Fraser clean. I know it's 99.
This is in the clean cut era. Yeah, though.
Yeah. So he's rocking the 5 o'clock shadow for some of it. But I do feel like, wow, I would think he was more handsome if he had a beard. But I'm going to go ahead and take O'Connell, Rick O'Connell, third overall pick. What do you got him in?
I mean, I get it. He's in The Whale recently where he doesn't look
great. Yeah, for the fact I am drafting this Brendan Fraser.
He did not age like a fine wine in that particular film. He does a great job in it, though. He was nominated for an Oscar. Actually won the Oscar. I'm sorry. He did an incredible job. And then also fun ones for me that I have mentioned before for him, actually, which is Blast from the Past. He's also very handsome in that one. And then Tarzan, where, he's showing off his abs. And George of the Jungle, he is kind of like a theme of silly, fun, hot hero guys, but with the comedic turn to them for a while. All
Encino
of those,
Man, where he's just a caveman Encino with Pauly Shore.
Oh my God, Encino Man. I always forget about
that.
What
was the one with him and Elizabeth Hurley? Was that Bedazzled? The one where she's the devil? I liked that as a kid.
I weirdly liked that movie as well. Yeah. Actually, I did a rewatch of that a few years ago and like it's silly, but it's kind of still a fun time. So I think that's Brendan Fraser's style, you know? Like they're silly, but they're still a good time.
And then when you see him in real life, because when he gave that Oscar speech, you're just like, oh, he's kind of a dork. So it makes total sense that he can play these badass characters, but have this air of levity to it.
He's just like a wholesome, sweet, dorky guy with what I assume might be some level of social anxiety. And I say that with love because bro, same. So yeah, all right. It's so cute.
You've got the fourth pick now. And then I guess if we're doing traditional snake, you actually get the next two. So you get 4 and 5.
Oh, goodness. Okay. I was really distracted by Oded Fair. I was just like, that's all I want. That's all I
You're
need.
You're just like, can we take a break?
Can we take a break? I need a minute. Okay. So I think next one would probably be Arnold Vosloo, who plays Imhotep. He is ripped in this. He had to lose a little weight for this, actually, and put on some muscle. But you see him like half naked for a good section of this film.
He gains confidence throughout the film as he gets his
body
back.
He sure does. His ass is out.
And at the end, he's just in his skivvies. Yeah.
He's just in his skivvies, you know, whatever, respect. But yeah, he looks good. He's got a great tan and he's got the nice bald head, actually. You know, you can't always pull that off. He has a nice bald head. My only complaint about him is that he opens his mouth way too much in this movie, but like the
they overdo that special effect a little bit.
They overdo that a bit, but he is a handsome fella.
I didn't know he was in Blood Diamond. I only saw Blood Diamond once, but I don't remember him in it.
I can like picture him, but I can't remember what his character was. I can picture his outfit. Yeah. But he was in Blood Diamond. He's in Mummy Returns as well. He's in G.I. Joe. I think he's in the Retaliation one. I can't remember which one, but he was in one of them. Mm-hmm. So yeah, he's done a few things and yeah, handsome guy, handsome guy. So wait, who's left?
I would say you've got maybe 4 people left to pick from or 5, depending on who you're ranking attractive wise.
Okay, who are we including, though, I guess? Is Patricia Velasquez included?
Oh, absolutely. Not Sina Moon? Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to have to take her. Again, this is basically the other couple in the story, and they are gorgeous. They're problematic, but they're beautiful. So yeah, she's in it. So what do we have her in?
So the only I know that she is, you know, she's still acting today. She gets work. She's been in lots of stuff. So not to downplay, but the only thing that I remember her from, and this might blow some people's minds, Arrested Development fans, this was Marta. So if you watched the first season of AD back in the day, Marta, where in that she is Mexican. So the fact that she's playing Egyptian in this is, again, like you said, a little interesting, potentially problematic. I don't know where she's actually from. Maybe she's just got really good range. Who knows? But in this, I mean, it must have been strange casting an actress who didn't have nipples in that first scene. I thought that was a little strange, but she's a scorcher. Yeah.
Yeah, she's beautiful. She's actually from Venezuela, in case you're curious.
Okay.
But I think she does play this very well, and she fits like kind of the look, or at least like what we understand to be the look. She is interestingly fluent in English, French, Italian, and Spanish. Just fun fact about her. She Maybe seems like an interesting lady.
Yeah.
And she's hot. So yeah, those are my next two.
Good choices. All right. So I got the next two. I guess I'll go ahead. I want to say, I don't necessarily think this is the most attractive person in the film, but I think they do a good job with this guy. And that's John Hannah as Jonathan, right? Is he playing Jonathan?
Yeah.
So the reason I want to give this is I think he's that British kind of more classic handsome.
Classically handsome guy, yeah, sure.
But what I like about his character is they don't overdo him. It's very clear what his role in the script is, if he's going to be this comic relief. And it kind of feels like he is to this script what, I can't remember the actress's name, but in Temple of Doom, how they just had her giving one-liners and they were falling flat after flat. Mm-hmm. In this, I do roll my eyes a couple of times at the Jonathan character, but they don't overdo it. Like, he is dumb in the right moments to kind of make it silly. So I'm going to go with Jonathan on this one.
Yeah, I think on the whole, I'd agree with that. He's done 4 weddings and a funeral. And then he also did The Hurricane, which I've never seen, but is with Denzel Washington.
Okay.
But he's in a more like British TV other than that.
He was supposed to originally, I guess the writers of Lost were going to cast him as the character of Charlie. And then they did some rewrites and the character got younger. So he ended up being played by Dominic Moynihan from Lord of the Rings. But Lost fans, this was originally going to be your Charlie, which would have been very different.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. How does it work now?
All right. I get one more and then you get the last pick. So you're getting stuck with pick number 8. So who do I want out of these two? Because I got two ways. I can take the super handsome Benny if I want, or I can go with, I'm going to double
Obviously,
he's
a gem.
I think I'm going to go with taking the accents. And I personally had as my 8th cast member, so I think you had somebody different who you wanted to mention. But I'm going to go ahead and knock out Jonathan Hyde, who is the Egyptologist, who God, did he have a run in the mid to late 90s and early aughts. Because
Titanic.
Jumanji.
Anaconda.
Yeah. All Richie Rich. All the classics. Yeah. You
know, so. Which, like, he plays a persona. Like, I don't even want to say, like, he plays kind of this person. Like, he has the same energy.
He's like the Danny Trejo of British people at this point. It's like, you need somebody to be a generic British guy in a movie. Cast him.
But, like, a generic, I don't know, elitist, you know, British guy. Not...
he's got that very proper British accent.
Some people would say that's synonymous. It's not. But anyways, he has a very specific vibe, and it's interesting.
He was also in one of your movies. Our very first episode, we watched Crimson Peak, and he is in that. So there you go.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I thought you'd be more excited about that because you love that movie.
I do love that movie, but I'm trying to picture him.
I feel like he might be one of like their parents in the flashback or something. I don't think it's a big role, but I think he might be the dad of the kids.
He's like one of the businessmen. I don't remember. But yeah, no, anything Crimson Peak related makes me happy. You are absolutely right. But I do have a different last cast member than you. And I think that's who I'm going to go with because, let's be honest, Benny is not the guy.
Some women like humor. And I think Benny's the funniest character objectively. So
is he
not trying to sway your pick, but you should pick Benny.
No,
girls will love it.
I will not be picking Benny. And no, there is no, I don't know a single woman who loves Benny. But anyways, I will say Eric Avari. He is the curator of the museum, the librarian who takes Evie under his wing, and also ends up being older gentleman. He ends up being the head of the Magi. He is distinguished and handsome. I think that is fair to say. And yeah, can you imagine him as a younger man too? Like, I bet he was a handsome fellow. So yeah, I'm going to go with that one.
All right. Well, we got a good mix here. Go ahead.
He has also done the other mummies. And then he did, funnily enough, Stargate as well. Very similar type of role where he's playing an Egyptian. And what's funny is that on Stargate, they actually had the same Egyptologist. What is his name? Stuart Tyson Smith. He was the advisor on both, talking about all the Egyptian history and ancient Egyptian and like the language and things like that. And so they were both on Stargate as well, which, by the way, fucked me up when I was a kid, but
saw it. I haven't seen the other. I think I might have seen one of the other mummies. How the hell, I guess I don't want to spoil anything, but how is he in the other mummies anyway? So just to review our list before we get to poor Benny, who did not make the cut, honorable mention, ninth overall draft pick, Kevin J. O'Connor. What do you have down for him?
He did Deep Rising, which some people may have seen, but then he was also in Van Helsing. So I think he's definitely like a Steven Sommers pick here. Yeah. And I don't even remember who he was in Van Helsing, to be honest. But
that's how I felt about, I saw There Will Be Blood, and I was like, who was he in that? I think he plays kind of a skeez ball in that. I'm picturing him in the suit, but I don't remember.
He can only play creeper skeez balls, unfortunately. I'm not going to get into why, but I think so. And and unfortunately, in some of these, it's not as memorable as this one. And this one, you're right. He gets to be funny.
I think he's the high point of the film. I think without Benny, this movie would not be as enjoyable.
I think I just hate him so much, but he's supposed to be that way. So whatever, you know? Yeah.
He's like a Rizzo the Rat in human form, but like an even worse version of Rizzo.
He really is. I was going to say Rizzo we still like though, you know, Benny we don't like. Yeah, for sure. Okay. Yeah. So what are our finals?
All right. So let's review here. Maybe we'll put a poll up on the Insta.
I was going to say, I feel like we have to do a poll because like we can't objectively.
You'll have to remind me because this is coming out in what, like 3 weeks? We're recording early, spoiler. But so you have Oded Fehr. You have Arnold who plays Imhotep.
Imhotep.
You have Patricia who plays Anaxunamun, and you have Eric who plays the curator.
He's just credited as curator, yeah.
Okay. And then I have Rachel Weisz as Evelyn. I have Brendan Fraser as Rick O'Connell. I have two Jonathans. I have the Jonathan that plays Jonathan, and I have Jonathan that plays the Egyptologist. So we will put that poll up and see who's got the better list. It's going
to
be close.
We're going to have to show pictures, too. This is going to be a whole thing. Okay. Well, I'm interested to see because this is interesting.
I think I'm going to put the poll up as like it's going to be you're looking at two open doors, two open bedrooms, and with our two groups in there, and it's like which orgy are you? You've been invited to both of these. Which room are you walking into?
This is getting dirty.
Hey, it's the mummy. Right. We have to.
I love love it. All right. Well, stay tuned for that. We're going to find out who won. But into some good stuff as far as the plot summary and a few little production gems for y'all. But first and foremost, the summary, if you haven't seen it, at an archaeological dig in the ancient city of Hamunaptra, an American serving in the French Foreign Legion accidentally awakens a mummy who begins to wreak havoc as he searches for the reincarnation of his long-lost love. Accurate.
Yeah.
Not too spoilery.
I was going to say, can we throw down a spoiler alert right here?
Yeah, I think it's time. I mean, it's been, again, it's 99. It's been 25 years. I think we can move right along, which also is that terrible. Ugh, I didn't need to know that out loud, that it was 25 years old. Anyway, turn around. Don't drown. It's spoiler time.
So the reason I wanted to throw that down is what you just said is the plot summary gets told to us at one of the weak spots of this film, gets told to us at the beginning of here's exactly what's happening. Here's this narrator telling you, here's the thing that happened. We get three more goddamn scenes of exposition on everything that we already know is happening, or like, oh, here's this, what's gonna happen. That is like one of my big gripes with this. And I love this fucking movie. It's so much fun. But the exposition between that, between when they find the chest and read out the curse that's about to be inflicted on them, then they go meet with the curator and he explains again, we've been watching this. So there is a shit ton of exposition in this film.
Interesting. I feel like it's interspersed in ways that it doesn't feel like that to me as
much. It's conversational, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. I will say, people loved this movie, like you said. This is a good movie. It's a good time. I don't know. The ratings are kind of a mixed bag, but it made $417 million against an $80 million budget, which, fun fact, $15 million of that alone was special effects. So we're talking about the aging of special effects here. This was big special effect money at the time, for sure.
They spend $15 million on the special effects and $12 on the pile of goo smoke that comes out and tries to go into the body. They're like, okay, we $5 on that. Use the rest on the sand tricks. Yeah.
It's like kind of iridescent. You know, it's not bad. Anyway, yeah. But another fun fact about this one that I wanted to share, that I meant to share when we talked about Brendan Fraser, actually. This was almost Tom Cruise's role of O'Connell. And funny, many of you probably already know, he did the reboot of this, of The Mummy, later on.
Did you see it?
No, because I am a purist and I think it's rude. So yeah, I have no plans to see it. I also didn't hear great things because I think people, like, again, they think that this is the one, you know, this is the good one, at least of our era, it's the one. And yeah, it didn't work out with Tom Cruise. And it's so funny because he had wanted to do it. I can't remember what the story was, but he had wanted to do it, didn't work out. They also thought that Brendan Fraser would bring the dynamic that we just talked about with him, of like the lightheartedness of not taking himself too seriously and make it more fun to kind of root for him. And that's my understanding, actually, about Tom Cruise's take on it, is that it wasn't as fun. It got a lot darker and more intense. And I'm sorry, I don't need to watch Tom Cruise run through a desert. Like, you know, they just wanted to get the run shot of Tom going through the desert. So I was like,
I assume there's a scene where he runs up a pyramid, jumps off, grabs a helicopter. Like, that has to be in there, right?
Yeah. He's definitely, there's a long run scene of him at some point, and it's either across a dune or it's up a pyramid. There's got to be one.
Again,
of them,
never judging. I too am 5'4", but Tom Cruise has definitely got a little short man complex of like, they need to see me do my own stunts. Okay, Tom. Okay.
He's got to show how manly he is in some way or another. But he can run fucking fast. I'll give him that. Like, it's impressive. But we've also seen it a dozen times. I'm all good. Thanks, though. But he was supposed to do it. It was funny. But he also... it kind of takes us a totally different direction. And I think that shows in this film, is like, it's just more fun. It definitely has like the horror effect, like you said, and it kind of feels like an action thriller horror type, but it also, it's interspersed with like quite a bit of comedy, which I love.
It merges a lot of genres really well. I think if you take one of those out, it's a totally different film and it's not as fun to actually get through it. Yeah. It has actual scares. It has things that scare you regardless of how shitty the Beatles might look in their CGI or whatever they were using at this time, but it has moments where you jump. It has moments that genuinely
scarabs,
creep you out.
Okay, scarabs.
Scarabs. It has, moments that make you laugh. It has clever lines of dialogue and arguments and things like that. And then it has really good action set pieces. It is a perfect combination of those three genres.
Yeah, I think I totally agree. I think it kind of hits a sweet spot of all of those things. And yeah, if you removed it, it wouldn't work the same way. I think also there's a healthy amount of nerdness in it. It is not totally accurate, but I do think it taps into, I don't know about you, and I was going to ask you this actually as initially as part of the cold open of like, were you as obsessed with Egypt as I was as a kid? Because I feel like I know so many 80s, 90s kids who had an Egyptian phase, right?
Of like, no, I was more into dinosaurs. I was a dinosaur kid.
A dinosaur kid. I think it is maybe one or the other.
Yeah, you can't like both. You cannot like both. The war is coming, people.
Right. I think we're going to throw down because I was, I mean, dinosaurs are cool, don't get me wrong, but I was not obsessed with dinosaurs. I was obsessed with Egypt and like read everything I could and got really into it. And they do a pretty decent job of having this homage to Egypt that's relatively accurate. Like some of the language stuff is really cool, like hieroglyphs versus Heratic. And Heratic is more of a cursive version of hieroglyphs a little bit.
Is that why they use the authentic Egyptian font in the subtitles?
isn't that like papyrus or something ridiculous?
That was on Microsoft Word. Somebody pulled it. It was like, oh, I have the best idea in the editing room.
It was funny though, because they don't even caption all the ancient Egyptian. I don't know. Like I watch things with subtitles because I'm 1,000 and the captions will say when he's speaking at several moments, ancient Egyptian. Yeah. Like it just says that. It doesn't say what he's saying. And then sometimes it's the papyrusy font and whatever. But the actual tattoos and things that are referenced are relatively alluding to certain things that are happening and relatively accurate. And there are hieroglyphs, there's Heratic, which she says she can read, and there's stylized hieroglyphics, which is what's tattooed on the Magi, for example. So anyway, it gets kind of interesting if you like read all the little things. So I'll point them out as we get there. But there's some fun things. But to start, your pick for Hottie of the film, Rachel Weisz, her character, Evie, is named after an actual person. So she was in tribute to Lady Evelyn Hebert, who was the daughter of an Egyptologist, Lord Carnarvon, and he was present. They were both present at the opening of the tomb of King Tut, Tutankhamun, in 1922.
That's interesting.
So she is named for that character, which is fun because I think she gives a little bit of that backstory that like Egypt's in her blood and it's in her family and all of that. And she's named for a character where that was very much true.
And God, did they learn again? I'm sorry to make this. I try not to just go super hard on one theory, one comparison, one opinion throughout episodes. But I feel like this one, I'm just going to keep coming back to, boy, did they take Temple of Doom and just make a better version of it? Because this female character is actually fleshed out. She has a personality. Do I love that she is just falling for this guy who kisses her without her permission? Like, that's a bit tropey, but it feels earned when we get there. But they actually flesh this character out and let her stand on her own two feet and have thoughts and opinions and be, they even say at one point, oh, they're led by a woman. She is the leader of their little expedition group. So
yeah,
I just love that they actually give Evelyn an actual character as opposed to what we saw in Temple of Doom.
Yeah, and I think I will say, like, I know it's cheesy that the two leads or whatever fall in love with each other, but I will say I do agree. I think it feels earned. She doesn't like him at first, which is somewhat tropey, but it is not uncommon of, like, meeting people and you warm up to them. And also you warm up to them in the thick of some trauma and some crazy action, right? And so she does see his character flesh out as well. And I think that informs her opinion of him. You know, he does really protect her. And yes, like you said, he's heroic and he's handsome and he's funny and all these things. But for her, she sees like a couple a little bit more vulnerabilities of him. He doesn't seem immortal to her, right? He just seems smart and he has his shit together and he's holding to his word throughout, right? Like you see him foiled against Benny in that way too, right? Benny's just a conniving little weasel. And even though he comes off a little bit as a scoundrel at the very beginning, he comes around and he holds to his word and he takes her there and he could have just vanished. You know what I mean? He could have just disappeared and he shows up and shows more of these like, you know, honorable sides to him that I think ultimately do win her over in a way that feels mostly authentic.
Yeah, the dynamics between the different characters in this are really what drive it forward. Because even though it combines those three genres we talked about really well, I think if you didn't have the Evelyn and Rick dynamic, where you're sort of like the will they won't they, we know they will, but it's this playful, flirty.
There's a dancing around
and
it.
I like the way that they build it up. It's like cute of her in her hotel room or whatever on the boat and saying it wasn't even that good of a kiss, like talking herself out of it. And then later when she's drunk and being adorable and she's like, I'm going to kiss you, Mr. O'Connell, and then just passes out. And it's like, okay, it's very sweet to watch this sort of play out.
Yeah. And it feels like they're also like becoming friends too. I do feel like there's a little bit of that, of like they're becoming at least partners in this as well. And I think that's fun. And then, yeah, she's being cute and she's being silly and she has, but I like that that's not what she's doing all the time. Most of the time she's nerding the fuck out. And
she's just excited to be there.
She's excited to be there. She's loving this experience. She's explaining to everyone all these things. Like, I love that, you know, the other differing group goes after the gold and the treasure and the whatever right away. And meanwhile, she's like, y'all, you don't even know. You're scratching the surface. There's a whole other thing here. Let me teach you this mirror trick. And I love that, like, she just knows something that nobody else knows in these, in this situation. And she's, it does feel like her first application of this, right? Like, she has all this book knowledge and now she's finally getting to be in the thick of it. And so she's so excited. And she has been, as we know, striving for this like field experience so that she could become a Benbridge scholar, who's, you know, her ultimate goal and whatever. So I love seeing her nerd out and be preoccupied with where she is, the history of it, the goal of it. And yes, she is noticing this man and she's attracted to this man, but it's not the main point. It's not the main point of the story. It's not the main thing that she is there for, certainly.
Right. I love that dynamic with her and Rick. I also think the Rick and Benny dynamic drives so much of this. I love how Benny betrays him at every turn. Rick knows, he knows exactly what he's dealing with. There's the multiple times where he's like, see you, Benny, or bye, Benny, throws him off the boat, throws him off the horse, all this stuff. And then, of course, we get the ending of where he's like, see you, Benny, bye, Benny. But they have this thing. It's so funny to see all those moments. And then to see there's the one night where both groups are sitting around the campfire and Benny and Rick are just sitting next to each other chilling until Evelyn comes. He's like, you're in her seat. But they can be bros when they're not busy betraying each other. I like that a lot, too.
Yeah, I think Benny is like most certainly playing his like annoying little brother. You know, he kind of treats it as Benny can't be anything other than this. And he's very aware of who he is. And he just sort of accepts him for who he is. He's got this annoying little brother type. So he's like this protectiveness of him. I mean, I've had people like that in my life personally, of like, you probably wouldn't think that you would like them. You would just move on from them or whatever. But you have this weird protectiveness of them for one reason or another. And he does. He tries to save him repeatedly, even though he's a piece of shit. And ultimately he can't. And it is what it is. But he tries, you know. And I think, again, that's why he's the more honorable of the two. And you see that show up over and over for him.
Yeah. I think Jonathan is probably like the weak link of the group. As I said, they don't overdo him, but at times it does feel like he is just a tag along that is there to occasionally drop a witty one-liner, but he gets a couple chances to shine. I like when I think the entire boat sequence is a lot of fun when Odette Fair's group kind of comes onto the boat and attacks, but
he accidentally gets the, you know, key and all the things.
I was going to say he accidentally immolates somebody. Like, he just accidentally immolates
And like, that's the thing, like, he's defending his, you know, his sister and defending them. And it's just incidental, you know, it's not at all intentional. And I think he's a Benny foil too. You know what I mean? Like, they balance each other out but he's the quote unquote good guy, but he's like, he's like kind of the dummy good guy. He's just kind of like there. But what I like about him too, is that he's almost like the party boy smart guy, right? He's still smart. Like, you learn that he's learned a lot of this. You know, he's reading hieroglyphics. He's reading hieratic, just like her. But he just doesn't apply himself, right? Like, he wants the easy version. He wants to find the treasure. He knows the things that he needs to know to hopefully get the big payday, right? Like, he just has very different motivations than she does. And she's there to learn and touch the history of it all. And he's there to, like, make a buck.
He was definitely in one of those British fraternities in college. Where
Cambridge or whatever. Yeah.
You're going to school. You're reading your books. You know what me and the boys are doing? We're having tea and crumpets like that. Like, go hard. Beta, beta, beta.
That's what they do in the British frat system for it's, sure.
You know, you're a nerd on Egypt. I'm a nerd on England. So,
oh, please, no English people listen to this podcast. Bless.
Can we pivot real quick? I know we're deep in the character sort of stuff, but I want to talk. So when you say the visual effects and you feel like they've held up for the most part really well, which one specifically stood out to you as like, oh, that actually looks really good?
I mean, I like the reveal of Hamunaptra. I think that's fun. Like the way that they show that. And it's funny that the
sky kind of like, yeah, the clouds opening up. Yeah.
The clouds opening and the mirage effect on a desert, which is, you know, often referenced. It's a real thing. You can have this mirage effect and see things that aren't there. But in this case, it is there. Right. And so like, that's kind of cool how that's done. I think it's funny that they all race toward it. Like it's not moving. If you just keep going straight, you're going to run into it, you know, but they race toward it. I love that whole scene too, because
they have a $500 bet. That's why they're racing.
Obviously they're gonna win on the Evie's gonna win. That's my favorite part, is that Evie wins out of all of them, and it's because she likes her camel and thinks it's cute.
Did you do research on this? Are camels, I can't imagine that camels are as fast as horses. Like I feel like the horses would obviously win.
Camels are pretty fast. I don't think they're as fast as horses. I didn't research that, but I will say they are more acclimated to the environment, you know, I think is what it is. And so like they're more able to hustle in this environment. I think that's part of it. And their literal hooves are different and have more base to them than horse hooves. Like I think you could just make better progress on that sand is what it comes down to.
I always learn so much on this pod. Thank you. I didn't know that about camel hooves.
That's what I'm here for. You know, I have ridden a camel, so I made friends with my camel is what I'm saying. I deeply identify with Evie because I was very distracted by how cute my camel was. And everyone's talking shit about the camel in this movie. And she's like, I love them. I think they're cute. And that camel hears her and knows. And he's like, we're going to win this bet. And he hustles up for her because he loves her right back. I'm just saying, like, that's why they win. Is this camel relationship. That's
fair. Yeah, I think that the mirage looks good. There's a couple shots of the mummy in its later iterations that look good as he's sort of transforming bit by bit.
I think his progression of him, slowly.
When he's sitting still, it looks great. When he starts to get up and move around or stretch his mouth is when it gets iffy. It gets very,
I think his
like,
mouth is supposed to be really weird. But yeah, his mouth is my least favorite feature.
I didn't love. It's the second shot, even before he gets reanimated. They find the corpse. They open the tomb. He pops out with his jaw all weird. And
yeah,
they're talking about how he already looks kind of like moist. Juicy. Juicy.
Juicy.
Then gross. They cut for like 5 minutes. They go. We go
and
to the other room.
Different.
And then they cut back. And nothing's happened, but he looks that just annoyed the shit out of me this time.
Well, he's a different color. That's the thing for me. He's straight up a different color. And I'm like, he looks kind of the same, but
that
color,
part like, feels lazy. Like somebody should have caught that.
Yeah. It's just the coloring. Like all the rest of the effects were pretty much the same. So yeah, I agree. That one is distracting because she hasn't done the incantation at this point at all. And yeah, why is he a different color?
Yeah. For sure. There's also like the mummies near the end that come out of the, in like the final battle, they come out of that stone wall and they're made of stone, but then they start with just the main two that do that. That could have been practical. I don't know why they digitized that.
Yeah. I mean, I think part of that you would have to sort of digitize a little, maybe not. But yeah, I think the thing too is that they just look wimpy. They look weak. Like they come out of there looking like they're going to fall apart, at least for me. And so he's like, go wake the others. And I'm like, really? You want an army of those guys? That feels like that's going to help. Okay, sure. And then all of a sudden, like again, later they're like super tough and they're, you know, they're a bit more fleshed out and they're not like quite as limpy and all that. And I'm like, I don't know, maybe they're just stretching and they're like warming up after a couple thousand years. I don't know. But they were like not at all intimidating to me when they first come out of the wall.
The ones that come out of the wall, those guys look like shit initially, but the ones that pop out of the sand where their hands come up, those look great.
The practical effects look good. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of like what we were talking about on Temple of Doom of like missing the practical effects, you know, and there are things that are done, you know, really. What was the movie we were talking about recently where we're like, there are certain things where they were like, prove to me that you can do the digital effects better than the practical effects. Gosh, what was that?
The Thing. It was in The Thing episode. Yeah.
And so it's like, prove to me that you can do it better. And then they do. And that's when it wins out.
Now it's time to switch. But if not.
Right. But if not, like, why are we switching gears? I would totally agree with that. I think that's fair to say. But I do think they create overall a really authentic feeling environment. You know, the set on the whole is really beautifully done. And I have a note. It's so funny. It reminds me of a Mario Kart track. Like, there were multiple points where, like, the levels and, like, the turns. And, like, when the Beatles run after them, or the Scarabs run after that, him and I think it's Jonathan are escaping the Beatles, and they jump off to the side of this little ramp. And I'm like, that's a Mario Kart move. So I was like, it was so fun to me to watch this time, too, because I was like, it still feels like this very authentic set, but it's like a course. You know what I mean? It's like you move through it throughout this film of, like, it's definitely this action set where there are different things happening in these different scenes. And I love that they cash in on that. You get so much of the environment, and in the environment itself is a threat in a number of ways. And it feels like this maze, and it feels like a tomb would feel, right? Like, that is how these were built. If you didn't know this about pyramids and these burial grounds, like, they are genuinely these labyrinths, right? Mm-hmm. And there are various levels, and the pharaoh is buried at the deepest level with their treasure, and it's supposed to be very hard to get to. That's the point. You're not supposed to be able to rob the pharaoh of their treasure that they would take into the afterlife. So
when you say the pharaoh is that the pharaoh that comes in at the very beginning and catches Imhotep?
He's the pharaoh.
You mean that really white guy that comes in and he's like, what the hell are you doing with my wife? That guy? Because I'm like, what the fuck, guys?
He doesn't look as authentic. I'll give you that. He doesn't look as authentic.
He looks like, I don't know, my grandfather who lived in Florida and they just painted his eyebrows black. Like,
he's, well, there's actually a couple things about, I will say, like, going to the production and the build out of it all. The pharaoh dynamic is very interesting with the three of them, and they do bury this treasure and they create this place where, like, it can go into the desert if mm-hmm. anybody, like, comes for them. And that's interesting. I've never heard in, like, any of my nerddom something like that in particular. But Hamunaptra in particular wasn't really real. What I think they're trying to emulate is the Valley of Kings, which is where the pharaohs are buried with their treasure. And so this is where this particular pharaoh would have ended up. You know, he would have been buried there, and he probably was already, like, stocking up essentially prior to his death. But what's interesting is that all of his guard is what comes after Imhotep, right? Like, Imhotep has his priests and they reanimate later. So does the guard actually later in its own form, like, that he eventually can control because he's all powerful, whatever. But the guard also has all these tattoos on them where, if you look at it and you research it, actually gives away the plot. Like, in that scene. So the pharaoh, he comes and he, like, catches them and he threatens them and they kill the pharaoh, right? And they have tattoos on them that are telling the story of this, like, hidden city in the desert that hides this monster, and that they must guard and protect this ground and this monster. And it's before he's even died. So they're coming to kill Imhotep and they have it already tattooed all over their chest.
We just couldn't get enough exposition in this film.
We're couldn't like, get enough exposition.
Put it in the tattoos, you know? Too.
They're like, we know this is coming. We know this is coming.
We so, really want to dumb this down for the viewers. If it's not clear what's happening. Also, their plan was so fucking stupid. I was like, wait, what did they just say? Basically, we're going to kill this guy and give him the most brutal death possible. Guys,
it's the Hamdai ritual.
In the unlikely event, there's like a minute chance that he ever gets found and somebody reads these words, he'll be immortal. But, like, the death itself is going to be awesome. That plan is so fucking stupid.
I will agree. I think that's such a silly plan. I think it's kind of cool, like, that it's such a hardcore ritual that, like, in some ways you're kind of punished for carrying it out, you know, because there is a possibility that you could face this person's wrath later, because he becomes all powerful as a result of this ritual, the Hamdai ritual, which, by the way, I looked up, there's, like, not really something like that I can find.
Okay.
But the Magi are real, and they were guardians of the desert in a little bit different sense, but they are real, and they have this tattoo on him and on his face, like he's saying. But there's a bunch of different interpretations of it, because it actually is all hieroglyph, and, like, the things on his cheeks are, like, they're not hieratic, or Arabic, which is what people think they are. They're actually stylized hieroglyphs as well. And it's supposed to be basically that he's calling out this hidden entity in the desert that they are, like, guarding. And then this part on this forehead says Imhotep. So, and there's a couple, it's slightly misspelled. So there's a bunch of theories about it. Like, is it just a mistake, or is it, like, implying that, you know, something else? Is it Imhotep or Imhotep? because it refers to also the end of the world, the ancient Egyptian netherworld is also like very close to that spelling. So are they guarding this netherworld? Are they guarding Imhotep, the high priest? Like, what exactly is it about? But that's what's tattooed on them throughout.
Interesting. But like, yeah. I heard you say, so the Magi are real people.
It's a real group.
It was a real group.
And they were guardians, but I don't.
Are they all as handsome as Odette Fair?
No, absolutely not. Okay, he's the most gorgeous of them all, which is why I'm going to win.
I was on Google Flights looking at Egypt, and I guess I'll cancel that. Never mind.
Yeah, I mean, if you don't get to see him, then why why bother? Let's be honest.
I want to pivot a little bit and talk about just the comedy in this, because I think it's brilliant. I wanted to talk about this one during the visual effect. Was the bookcase collapse at the beginning, was that all practical? It looked practical. It had
I think
to be,
so.
Right?
Yeah.
I was like, okay, that's cool. Like, that's such a simple, it's a very 90s joke, maybe 80s even, of like, look at this like domino effect collapsing. Hilarious, yeah, by 1999 standards. But I was like, that's, if we had done,
I also felt
more
for
that,
her, I was like, I would totally do something like that. I feel you. I would be like, I'm not going to go all the way down the ladder. I'm going to lean. It's going to be fine. If I just lean, I would totally have done that.
Yeah. The silliness, that's more of a silly thing, but the humor in this is just, it's, some of it's visual, some of it's physical, some of it is script based. I love when he's getting hung at the beginning and he says, any last requests? And he's like, yeah, loosen the knot and let me go. And then they let have the go back and forth where, again, no subtitles, but
he's,
you know,
like,
what they're,
should I check?
He's
like,
is he allowed to
this?
Do that? Yeah, that is a great, great scene.
I like on that one too, that they show him actually getting hung, because you get this like split second of, I mean, if you see it more than once, you know that what
I mean,
happens.
It's a good thing his neck didn't break. Jeez.
Right. And I like, that's the only reason that the story continues, right? Because you need someone to take her there, is because his neck didn't break. So kind of interesting.
I had read that Brendan Fraser actually passed out during that scene. He was actually doing his own stunts and was being choked for some reason. Why did they have him do that? I don't know.
I was going to say, should we be choking the actor? That feels like a bad plan.
Not unless unless he asked for it in his trailer.
Right. Unless it's consensual, guys. Yeah. Not appropriate.
Facts. I love Benny's scene when he's doing all the prayers with all the religious symbols to see one works. That is just, I don't think I've ever seen that done before. Or since.
It was really, well, I think he's also like very much owning that, again, he's ready to pivot at any time.
Loyalty.
Switch, like, no loyalties whatsoever, religious loyalties, no respect for any of that. I think that the downside that, of course, I mean, is historically accurate but doesn't hold up well, is that it's Hebrew that gets him to stop, and that's because it's the language of the slaves at the time that Imhotep lived. So, like, the
different
Jews
time,
were,
different time.
It was a different time, but the Jews were slaves in Egypt, and it's in this modern retelling, really, of course, problematic that he hears this quote language of the slaves and thinks, okay, well, I can put you to work then. And that's the thing that slaves
kind of messed
him
up what you could get away with in 500 BC. It's like, oh, the words they used were just so hurtful.
They weren't there. Nobody had like an HR D&I course. There was no training on this material.
I also
sure.
just ballparked. I have no idea when I'm not a history guy. So,
well, this was 3,000 years prior to 1923. So do that.
Okay,
math.
So I'm not that far off. I'm like off by 500-ish years. That's not in the grand scheme of history.
Mm-hmm. Which, you know, if you didn't know about Egypt, it was a multi-millennial civilization, right? Like it lasted so long to where, I'm sure you guys have heard this factoid, but it's a fun one, bears repeating, that Cleopatra was born closer to the invention of the iPhone than the pyramids. So... than the building of the pyramids. So, and she was the last pharaoh of Egypt. So it runs a very, very long span of history. And I think that's why it's such an intriguing period of history, of course, as well.
Interesting. Okay. So I guess one of the last things I want to talk through here is, I've said it before, the script is very tight. We don't even see, I mean, aside from the prologue, we don't really get the mummy coming into the story until almost halfway in. I think it's about at the hour mark where he gets unearthed. And they just do such a good job of breaking the script into these, to be fair, you know, expository conversations, but also some very heartwarming moments, some comedic moments, some action sequences. It plays out well. And then I love how from there, we do get this reveal of like, okay, this is the curse. Now we're chasing after these four guys to kind of harvest their organs for the mummy,
yeah,
leading him to be powerful enough to use all these plagues and whatnot. Like the script is just, for as forthright as it is with telling you exactly what's going to happen over the next 30 minutes of the movie, it's really well done because it does help pass the time.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, like you said, I know you called out the amount of exposition. I think it's placed well, though. Like the pauses in the action are, I think, intentional, because otherwise you would go for 2 hours straight with like one battle or thriller sequence after another. And I do think you get these pauses where they go back to Cairo and they have to regroup, you know. And but what you learn there too is like how powerful he's become and how he can follow them in that way. He's also not tethered to Hamunaptra, which is important information for us to have, right? Yeah. And then he unleashes these plagues, which again are historical plagues of Egypt, right? These are things that are presumed to have happened at various points, and they're referenced repeatedly as the 10 plagues of Egypt. And she unwittingly releases them. And I actually love that scene. It's the one time that she kind of gets her hand slapped a little, mm-hmm, of he jumps up and is like, hey, you must not read from the book. And you do see that he also, to some degree, knows his shit, because he knew not to do that. And her curiosity got the best of her. And, you know, and she says, you know, no harm ever came from reading a book. And I literally laughed out loud because I was like, listen, I'm pro read everything, but that is not true. And so we see it happen in real action, and it unleashes all of this. And the plagues, I think, are, from an effect standpoint, to your point earlier, are pretty well done on the whole. There's a couple moments where they don't quite land.
I go half and half. It's like the yeah, sores on the body, good practical makeup.
Yep.
The bugs, the locusts are actually okay in some
parts.
I
actually like the locusts, especially yeah, the zoom in on him, on mm-hmm, Jonathan Hyde, where he's like, he's covered in them and he's yeah, just, he's like, there's nowhere to go, guys. Like, it's going to be here. And I just love his look of resignation when that happens. And the blood thing, I think, is interesting as well. Like, that's pretty well done, because it's foreshadowed 2 seconds later, because Winston walks through the water multiple times. And so you see, and then you see it go red, you know, things like that. So I like these tethers to the history, to the, you know, Egyptian storytelling of it all as well, and then how that's applied to this.
I found myself thinking, like, during this, what would be the best double feature to watch back to back with the mummy? Because I was like, you could do Prince of Egypt, which is the biblical sort of story with this. Yeah. What was the other one I thought of? Aladdin would be a good one. Like, I'm trying to think of what would be the most fun double feature that you could watch back to back.
Aladdin's not Egyptian.
But it doesn't have to be. I'm not saying it has to be an Egyptian film. I'm saying, what's the most fun double feature? It's another one about searching for treasure. There's a genie in that one instead of a mummy.
The genie is a fun one, I think. Any genie story is always fun, actually, I think.
Or what's the one that came out that got all really bad reviews a few years ago because it had an all-white cast? Was that Princes of Egypt? Gods of Egypt?
Maybe it was. Maybe Gods of Egypt. Because I think
the one with, like, Eric Bana,
just the animated.
But it was just like, hey, it's 2015 or whatever. Maybe we don't cast all white people.
Let's up our game a little. Yeah, this was 99, so we can give them a little bit of a pass. Yeah. And I will say, like, they hired some people that at least were closer. But yeah, they definitely, like, all the priests and priestesses and, like, some of the guards that are there later, like, are definitely painted white guys. You know, like, definitely a bunch of just, like, totally painted white guys for sure. So yeah, I like all the nerd aspect of it. And I like how they bring it back to this ritual that we saw the ritual half completed before. And I like that you start to see it again, and it follows some of the same steps. How did you feel, though, about her, like, coming to life in her mummified version, you know, and chasing Evie around? I thought that was, like, the practicality of it was interesting, but I thought she had these, or the makeup itself, but I thought that dynamic was a little bit odd. Like, she looked a little bit, God, what does she remind me of? Of, like a zombie almost, with, like, her limited movements, and the way she moved was a little weird for me.
Yeah, it's one where I feel like it's better to not think about it, because the ritual wasn't completed. So why is she able to get up and start moving around zombie style? Because the whole point was that Evie needed to die to give her a vessel to live in. So it's so why silly.
Why is she animated to go after her in that sense?
But they at all the same a battle. Time,
they all had someone that they.
That's what I was gonna say. Was that's the trope, right? Whether you're watching a Marvel film or a soldier fit, it's like everyone needs somebody to fight in the final battle. Yeah. Otherwise, what's the point? So I get why they did that. And to your point, she does look great. The practical effects, the makeup, she moves around great. And it's just like, we need somebody for Evelyn to fight. It's gotta be a girl, equal rights. So,
but I will say that whole ending sequence of all the little separate fights that are happening, I think complement each other well. Yeah. And I think are timely. Like they don't overdo it. Like it is a lot at once, but I don't think they overdo it. And they have several fun moments in it. Like I love when Jonathan grabs his gun and guns out of his holsters and he looks like he's been violated. He's like, what the fuck, you know? And he's like, okay, fine, you need a gun, but also like, did you just, you know, this face? And then I love the like the match on the jawlines, which
that's a good
Odette Fair. I was like of course
I'd read that fan fiction. I would read that fan fiction
for sure.
I love the it's a thing. It's weird when you watch these films that you haven't seen in, you know, 20 years or so. But I saw this when I was 15 probably, and maybe the last time I watched it was like 17 or 18. But the zombie head home run where he knocks its head off and then it's like juggling it and he whacks it toward the screen. It doesn't look perfect. It's not the greatest digital effect, but it's a cool, it was like a core memory of mine of, oh fuck, I forgot about this. It looks so fun. Yeah.
I will say my one critique about how it all kind of wraps in the battle sequence is it feels quick actually when they start to lose the battle. Like when she is killed, like in a you know, very similar way to the way she was killed before, she's being stabbed and, you know,
they
whatever
overdo, she's going to be. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but they overdo that shadow shot in this.
They do the shadow
with the pharaoh at the beginning. They have the shadow of the guy getting eaten by the sand, which is actually pretty cool. They run it back here with the shadow of her getting killed. I get it, but they do overdo it just a little bit.
Well, and it's like, if you're spending all this on all these effects, like, why are we not just showing a couple of these, you know? So, yeah. But I will say, again, she feels like she dies all of a sudden, very quickly. Mm-hmm. She's straight up dead. And that's been Imhotep's, you know, motivation this whole time. So all of a sudden, his reason for living is gone. And so then he, of course, rages and is like, all right, well, you guys are going to die now, too. And then again, he's taken pretty quickly. You know, as far as the four horsemen of the apocalypse come riding through and take his soul, and then he just stabs him. And like that happens in very quick succession for me. And I don't think it's like bad. I don't mean that. I mean, it's the story itself makes sense, but it did feel like all of a sudden in that sequence.
I'd be in agreement with that. It does feel a little we've taken our time to get here and we've told these, you know, it feels like a four chapter story, basically. It's broken into these chunks. And so, yeah, the last 5 to 10 minutes do feel like, hey guys, we got to wrap this up. Let's kill kill all the bad guys. The whole him getting carted away or his immortality getting stolen by the Death Riders, whatever they are, the hearse from hell is weird. But I do like that he doesn't realize what's happened and he just approaches Brendan Fraser and just stabs him. I like that it's like, oh, he's mortal now. Like, fuck him.
Yeah. Yeah. He doesn't quite get it, what happened. He's like, well, I'm still here, so I'm just going to, you know, battle it out anyway. And then he dies. And it is almost fitting. Don't get me wrong. Again, it just felt a little abrupt. And I do. But then, they kind of wrap everything up. And then they cut over to, like, they're running out. Benny gets left behind and eaten alive in all the ways he deserves. But Ardeth Bay has survived. And you see him go, like, battle these zombie guys. And you think he's totally dead, you know, and then they get out of the pyramid and he's like, just taps him on the shoulder. That's, like, peace, bitches.
He's like already caught up with them on his camel and it's like that feels a little weird. I feel like he should have come limping out of the pyramid, not just been like,
no, he's like,
I'm
good
here
to go.
See you later.
What we didn't realize is actually he's the superhero who's invincible.
Maybe
apparently, because he just walks the fuck out of the pyramid. But it's like that and the death is only the beginning line being repeated as he's falling into the pool are very, to me, just like, there's going to be a sequel place. Like, it's not logical. It's just, we're leaving the door open here is what.
And
those,
I mean,
two
you
are
could
for
make
me.
An argument. I'm not going to on this podcast, but you can make an argument that if not for this movie, The Rock's film career might not exist, because he's in the second one briefly. He gets the Scorpion King. I think that's his first major film role. And from there becomes The Rock Dwayne Johnson that we know today. So, you know, this franchise kind of gave him his start.
Yeah, you know, I love that you're like, I'm not going to make this argument, and then proceeded to make this argument.
Well, what I'm saying is I didn't do the research. Maybe he was in 18 movies before that one.
I think Scorpion King is his, you know, first big role. So maybe you heard it here first, folks, but also maybe you didn't, if that's problematic and we shouldn't have said
it. Well, thank you, Steven Summers, for all the shit I talked about you at the start of this episode. Thank you for starting this franchise.
Yeah, thank you. Well, all that to say, I mean, we just like kind of fangirled. There's a few things wrong with it, as we said, but it's mostly a really good time. What would you rate it with that?
Yeah, so listeners out there, like we've been talking about trying to keep our episodes a little tighter because we do tend, we started at like an hour-ish and now we're getting up to like 90 minutes, 2 hours, and who's got the time? And Mackenzie and I already talk fast enough. You don't want to listen to this in 1.5 speed. So we're trying to keep it a little tighter, and we got shit to do today. So I could have gone on for another hour on The Mummy. I do really enjoy this. And there's bullets in my notes that we didn't even touch on. We didn't even get into the like PTSD alcoholic who just wants to fucking die. He's just like, please, someone kill me. Put me in a battle.
I love Winston's death for him, though. That's a good little...
He gets that like dramatic send-off with the,
and
the
he's plane smiling.
Sinking. He's, and yeah, smile just... on his face and the dramatic music. It's for only having 6 minutes of screen time. He gets a pretty good send-off.
Good for Winston.
But yeah, I really enjoy this. I think it's got... It is not a perfect film. It is a fun movie to watch. Mm-hmm. And I'd rewatch it again in a couple weeks. I would go that far as to say, just like, it is a very rewatchable film. 80-ish% of the humor still lands. Some of it's a little cheesy, a little dated, but it does feel like one of those Indiana Jones style films where it's just, it's adventure, it's action. It doesn't really matter when it's taking place. It's just immersing yourself in this environment. So perfectly cast, I think, helps. The dynamics of the different characters helps. Some of the visual effects will not age well, so if you've never seen this before, you're probably gonna be like, what the fuck? But dude, on a personal level, it's just so fucking good. Like, I'm probably gonna give it an 8. It's a really good, fun fucking movie.
Okay, I just have to comment that my favorite thing about that whole spiel was you were like, we're gonna keep our things tight because we could talk about this forever, and then I'm gonna take 3.5 minutes to tell you your rating. I agree with your rating, though. I think it's very solid. I would probably land it like a 7, I would say. And okay. I won't go on about it because I think it's basically all the same points you made. I think there's certain things that don't land in there. Mostly is just a really fun time and a fun watch. So yeah, if you haven't seen it, which by the way, Skylar hasn't, and I didn't realize, or I would have
waited to watch
it.
What did the first timer think?
No, he didn't watch it because I thought he had seen it and I had to watch it. And like, he was at work. And so I watched it and he was like, you didn't wait for me. I haven't seen it. I felt really bad.
He's got homework.
But I was like, everyone has seen this movie. Like, what are you talking about? But anyways, apparently there are people who haven't. So if you haven't seen it, we recommend it is the moral of the story. So, but anyways, thanks for joining us today for our first iteration of Fan Jan. Next week, we are going to cover one that surprised me that it won, which was Muppet Treasure Island. Came out on top of a very interesting category to begin with, because again, we had like a weird genre situation, but against Beetlejuice, Spies in Disguise, and Grave of the Fireflies, Muppet Treasure Island won out. So that's what we're going to do.
I don't even think I've seen it, actually. Children's movie. My logic was like, they're movies that kids can watch, and granted, Beetlejuice isn't exactly a kid's movie, but I saw it when I was a kid. Grave of the Fireflies, I've heard, is very dark, but it was marketed as a kid's movie, and Spies in Disguise is obviously a kid's movie. So that was my logic when I put the category together.
Well, and I had given you a different category. So when I saw the poll, y'all, I was like, okay, or not. I'm confused. And then I was like, I don't want to do Beetlejuice because I want us to do Beetlejuice later, like back to back with the new one anyway. So thank you guys for voting the way that you did. But I don't think I've seen Muppet Treasure Island. So
I've seen bits and pieces. Janelle really stands by it. So I think I've sat down and watched 15 minutes of it while she was watching it. But yeah, looking forward to it.
Well, Janelle, we will report back. So come back and hear that one next week. But for now,
for now, follow us on Instagram. You guys heard us mention FanJan. Most of our polls and interactivity take place there. So if you're like, what the fuck is going on? Why didn't I get to vote? Just make sure you're on our IG and you don't have us muted, because that'd be messed up and personally very hurtful.
And rude. I don't want to know.
You can also watch the video portion of this podcast if you want to see me struggling not to make noise with my jingle bells and my drink and ice cubes today. You can see that on YouTube. You can watch it on Spotify videos. You can also email us at wedrinkandwewatchthingspod@gmail.com. And that's about it, I think.
Yeah. Well, for now, though, go have a drink and watch a thing. Cheers.
Cheers.